Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, co-founder of Literal Humans and co-host of this pod.
I'm William Gadsby-Pete, the other co-host and co-founder in your life.
And today we've got John Leland, who's the Chief Strategy Officer at Kickstarter. John, welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to talk today about the voluntary carbon market, which is something that we have not talked about on the show. Just for a little bit of context, as I mentioned, John's Chief Strategy Officer at Kickstarter and also the co-founder of the 4-Day Workweek campaign, which we love as a 4-Day Workweek agency. That's how John and I got connected. During his time at Kickstarter, John has created the Insights team, doubled the revenue impact of the community engagement team, and overseen international expansion and spearheaded the company's sustainability efforts. That's a lot, John. You've got a lot done there.
Well, I've been at the company for 10 years, so
okay.
I've had time to move around the company and do a lot of things.
Got it. John is a passionate environmental activist and has been the driving force behind Kickstarter turning into a climate neutral company. So let's dig into that. Would love to just get a brief explanation from you to start off, John, about, you know, give our audience some context here. Like, what is the voluntary carbon market and why is it so critical for companies like Kickstarter?
Yeah, so the voluntary carbon market enables companies to offset their carbon emissions by investing in environmental projects that prevent, reduce, or remove carbon emissions. It's all voluntary, right? So this is a choice, voluntary choice that companies are making to reduce, offset their carbon emissions. That involves a process where, as a company, and I'm about to do this for Kickstarter, every year we count up our carbon emissions. Those emissions are classified as scope 1, scope 2, or scope 3 emissions typically. You count all those up and you say, okay, we've emitted, let's say, 10,000 tons of carbon this year. You can go into the voluntary carbon market and purchase carbon credits that are supposed to represent 1 ton of carbon either avoided, removed from the atmosphere, to offset that carbon that you emitted for your company over the previous year. And if you offset the entire amount, ostensibly you are carbon neutral. The bit about that accounting process, I think it's important to understand what scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3 emissions are, because you'll hear about them a lot. It's a little bit confusing, but it's relatively straightforward until you get to scope 3. Scope 1 emissions are just how much fossil fuel do you burn? How much carbon do you directly emit as a company? And so for a company like Kickstarter, we own a building and we've got transportation, things like that. So any literal oil, gas, natural gas, we don't have coal, but anything that we're burning in our own facilities would be scope 1. Scope 2 is also pretty simple. It's just electricity, essentially, carbon emissions from electricity that we use. So this is the ways in which we're connected to the grid in New York State for our primary office building. That grid is burning natural gas primarily in New York State. So those carbon emissions are counted as part of our scope 2. Again, pretty simple. You can count those things actually relatively easily as a company from your gas bill and electricity bills and things like that. Where things get complicated is scope 3. And scope 3 is your supply chain and end use emissions. So if you're a company that is manufacturing products, well, what are the scope 1 and scope 2 emissions of all of the suppliers in your supply chain who are contributing to your product? And when people use your product, are they emitting carbon? So if you're a car company, your scope 3 emissions are massive because the supply chains are obviously pretty intense manufacturing processes, but also everyone's burning gas in their cars to go use your product. So scope 3 is where there's a lot more difficult accounting, and the bulk of a lot of companies' emissions sit in scope 3. What you're supposed to do as a company in the voluntary carbon market, if you're going to participate and say, oh, we're a good climate citizen, count up those emissions, and then go into this voluntary carbon market and buy credits that offset, at the very least partially offset or hopefully fully offset your carbon emissions.
And also to like kind of set the stage for audience, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. So, you know, the voluntary carbon market is predicted to hit a value of $3 billion in 2024. And we've seen a pretty significant increase in the number of carbon credits offered and certified each year since the 2015 Paris Agreement. So we'd love to just get your perspective on that growth. Is it just all good news there that it's this increase, or are there concerns about the growth or the lack of growth? Should it be growing faster or stronger? What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's important to take a step back and sort of understand, well, one, why would companies do this, and where does it fit into addressing the climate crisis? And the climate crisis really requires us to do three things at the highest level. One is to stop emitting carbon. That's decarbonization. That is the most important thing. We are continuing to just pump out billions of tons of carbon every single year. And the more we do that, the worse shape we're in. So the number one job is to reduce carbon emissions, decarbonization. Beyond that, we need to do two other things. We also need to start removing carbon from the atmosphere. That's carbon removal, is what it's generally called. And we have to do that at the order of 5 to 10 billion tons per year by 2040. Now that's starting from basically zero today. So going from zero to 5 to 10 billion tons of carbon removed every year is gonna take time to ramp up those technologies, understand what can scale to a billion tons and get those technologies to scale. That's the role that the voluntary carbon market's playing, is helping scale some of these solutions that can remove carbon from the atmosphere. You also have to adapt to climate change because climate change is already here. So much of it's already baked in that we also need to do preventative measures to adapt to it. So, but those are the three big buckets in climate change. Stop emitting carbon, remove what's already been up there, we've been pumping it into the air for 100 years, and figure out how to keep civilization going in the face of everything that's starting to come at us.
We talked in a previous episode about new legislation that's coming out of the U.S. that's helped seed some, you know, climate innovations. We talked about this, you know, carbon sequestration plant that opened up in California, like kind of the first of its kind, and is starting on that journey of, you know, getting to those, would you say, five to 10 billion tons of, you know, pulled out of the air. So are you hopeful that, like, sort of recent legislation and the spur, you know, from the government to kind of seed that innovation is going to get us there by 2040? Or like, where do you feel we are on our sort of timeline there?
We are behind. So this industry needs to grow much more quickly than it is growing. And it needs to be a healthy market that incentivizes the right types of technologies to grow in the right way. There is a lot of confusion in this market, I would say, between carbon capture and carbon removal. Sounds like the exact same thing, but actually is not, at least from a term of art perspective. Carbon capture is usually referring to basically putting a filter on top of a smokestack. That's like at the point where we're burning fossil fuels, we're just saying, like, instead of releasing it in the air, let's try to grab it and store it somewhere. Carbon capture sequestration. It's a controversial approach in climate tech, but that's really actually a decarbonization play, right? Because you're just trying to prevent new emissions from going into the atmosphere, as opposed to carbon removal, which is trying to go out, and this carbon is in the air, it's in the system. Sometimes it's in the ocean, but it's in the system and you're trying to grab it and pull it back in. So carbon removal versus carbon capture is an important distinction that frequently gets lost in these discussions. And carbon capture is very popular with oil and gas industries because it means they can continue burning oil and gas and then just try to capture all of that carbon or as much of it as they can capture and put it back underground. With carbon removal, we are not nearly where we need to be on that technology. So the types of approaches to carbon removal that exist today are nature-based solutions. That is most frequently taking the form of forests that are protected, that, you know, people are trying to get prevented from being logged, for instance. And then forests are really important, basically carbon stores, right? There's a lot of carbon in a forest. Now, what's challenging about a carbon is that they're part of what's called the fast carbon cycle. Everything, our bodies, trees, everything organic has carbon in it, which is great and beautiful, but we're all living on very short cycles. Our carbon and trees' carbon will re-enter the system once that tree dies or increasingly burns, right? So you see this in California, where all of their efforts to reduce carbon emissions in California, they've had some of the most aggressive legislation in the country, have been offset by the amount of carbon that's being released by forest fires. So for all of their work, it's all being undone by forest fires at this point. It's really heartbreaking. We do need to protect forests. We do need to protect biodiversity. We do need to be not just protecting forests, but creating new forests. But that's not going to get us out of this hole. That's not going to undo the last 100 years of carbon that we've been pumping into the atmosphere. And that's where you get into more engineered solutions. The first place that people tend to go with engineered solutions is called DAC, direct air capture. And it kind of makes the most sense as like the next thought, which is like, well, can we just suck this stuff out of the air? It's really appealing if we can do that. It's really hard to do that, though, because sucking carbon out of the atmosphere, carbon, for as much of a problem it is, it's not that dense in our air. And so these systems and machines that it takes a lot of energy to do this, to pump and filter tons and tons and tons of air. So building energy efficient machinery that can operate at a scale that we need is really hard. And we aren't anywhere close to that. You'll see headlines of, oh, this $20 million facility in Iceland just opened up and it's going to be removing 10,000 tons of carbon every year. Great. And a step on the journey, but 10,000 tons of carbon is nothing. Again, the scale we have to imagine is billions, 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 billions. And so how do you do this? We don't fully know. There's some really promising approaches. Enhanced rock weathering is one of the best. It's a complicated process. It's a natural process. It's just that some rocks, as they erode, it's like water hits them. That water, raindrops contain carbon, increasingly contain carbon because there's all that carbon in the air. They will chemically interact with carbonized rainwater and geologically store carbon. This is part of the long carbon cycle. And so if you can take more of those rocks and expose them to more rain and more of the elements, you can remove carbon from the atmosphere. And that's actually great because one of the things we do at billion ton scale as human beings is dig up rocks and move them around. So you can piggyback off those sorts of systems. These rocks also have additional benefits potentially. So in agriculture, you can use basalt rock, which is one of these rocks, to help with pH buffering, and they have nutrients. And so if you can figure out how to connect some of the systems we already have of digging up rocks, pounding them in little bits and spreading them in other places, which we already do for agriculture, just with not rocks that absorb carbon, then maybe you can get to a billion tons or a few billion tons there. But it's all, the science is still getting worked out. What's the purpose of the voluntary carbon market? It is to help these solutions on their way to becoming billion ton scale carbon removal systems in our society.
Yeah. Let's dig into that because I know we want to get to kind of the specific company level work that's being done and specific to what you're doing at Kickstarter.
In 2015, you guys named the planet as a stakeholder and, you know, have been working aggressively to become carbon neutral as you have. Like what have been the specific tactics and steps that you guys have used that maybe other companies could sort of replicate?
Yeah, so we did put environmental commitments into our charter as a business, which was a really important step for us. And so step one is recognizing that and actually making the environment and climate a stakeholder, a recognized stakeholder in your business, not as just a bolt-on greenwashing thing that you do as a kind of marketing ploy, but something that you really try to name and fold into how you operate as a business, that you cannot be successful as a business while destroying the planet. The first step that we really took was to partner with some companies that were launching an initiative called Climate Neutral. That was started by two companies, Peak Design and BioLite. They actually were companies that got started and have run many campaigns on Kickstarter. And they came to us and said, we want to launch this climate neutral initiative to help companies sort of certify themselves as good citizens on climate. I helped them run a campaign on Kickstarter that raised $150,000 to launch the initiative. And then we joined the initiative at launch, along with companies like Allbirds. And that's grown to hundreds of companies are now certified climate neutral every year. And that process involves counting our carbon emissions, which they help us with some calculators to make that easier, committing to at least two actions every year to reduce our carbon emissions. Because again, decarbonization is the most important thing here, is actually reducing less carbon. We don't have a huge amount of carbon emissions as a company, and that's true for most tech companies. And then offsetting whatever carbon emissions we do emit every year. So we go into the market and buy carbon credits that adhere to their standards, which starts pointing to one of the issues that people have with the carbon market, which is quality standards.
Yeah.
For the credits.
Let's jump into that because there's been a lot of criticisms of the voluntary carbon market, everything from, you know, double counting of emissions reductions to kind of it creating an excuse for rich countries and companies to kind of continue to pollute without much incentive to reduce emissions. There have even been claims of the voluntary carbon market being a sort of new form of colonialism in which like the global north is allowed to continue sort of, you know, carbon intensive lifestyles and profit making speculation while potentially hamstringing the abilities of less industrialized countries to kind of develop economically. And also there's, you know, junk offsetting projects, you know, carbon projects. So just curious to, you know, hear your responses to this kind of this litany of a bit of a loaded question, this litany of complaints against the voluntary carbon market and how you've tried to navigate those as you've implemented this work at Kickstarter.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think all of those criticisms have at least a certain degree of merit. There are a lot of issues with the system as it exists today. The fact that I can go into this market every year and basically set my own price for how much I want to pay for carbon is a real problem. If we weren't motivated by a genuine desire to do good by the planet, and I've seen companies do this, you just go for the cheapest thing and you say, hey, look, we're carbon neutral.
Yeah, tick the box.
That's the greenwashing.
Yeah.
Because you can buy a ton of carbon in this market for $1, $2 a ton, or you can buy it for $2,000 a ton. So if you're going to spend, let's say, $2,000, are you better off buying 1,000 $2 credits that are junk, or just buying one ton of the technology that actually can scale and is durable? And it's probably spending the money on the new technology that we need to be in place by 2040 for us to be operating at the sort of scale that we need to have in carbon removal. And so the PR story, and this is something we're grappling with right now, the PR story of, oh, we're climate neutral, isn't that so great? Aren't we good? It's starting to come at odds with what the reality is of what we need to do on climate. But we do need systems like this. So just saying, hey, it's not working great is not sufficient, because we need companies voluntarily participating in climate solutions. And you don't want to just tear down an entire structure that is facilitating that participation, even if it's really inefficient, without offering solutions on the other side. So we're looking at ways we can make alternative commitments to climate and put money behind it and put energy behind it, but make sure that money is more efficiently allocated to solve the problem at hand.
What fixes would you maybe make to the voluntary carbon market? Obviously, this is very magic wand, and it'll probably take years of legislation and campaigning before any of this comes. But say you are made supreme lord of the world and could just wave a wand and fix some stuff. Are there any clear fixes that would make the system we do have better and more fit for purpose rather than some of those perverse incentives?
I'll give you my personal perspective on this. But let's first lay out kind of what's happening. So there's a massive effort right now, both within the carbon market industry itself to increase standards, and then within sort of public policy government to increase the quality of credits that are in these markets. The Voluntary Carbon Market Integrity Initiative is one of these, right, where they're trying to create universal standards that are going to try to get rid of the junk. It's a little tricky to do this, though, because, again, it's a voluntary market. So if it's a voluntary certification and it's a voluntary market, it's just sometimes hard where people can choose whether or not they want to adhere to those voluntary standards.
Is there a point when we just say, hey, you know, we get to 2030, 2032, whatever, and we crunch the numbers and we sort of say there's no way we're going to hit the mark that we need to with a voluntary market, and we sort of, you know, politically, whatever, you know, force a shift to a regulated market? Is there sort of a reality in which that comes to pass? What do you think about that?
Yes, and I think that's everyone in the climate space, I think, would agree that a price on carbon mm-hmm. would be the best, probably the most impactful thing we could do for addressing the climate crisis. World Trade Organization allows you to impose carbon prices externally if you have that internally. So there are mechanics to not have to have the whole world come together and agree to this price. You can start piecemeal. We're starting to see this particularly out of Europe, where they're putting prices on carbon and creating these markets that are actually compliance markets where you have to do this. And there's a big fight around trade and their ability to enforce carbon costs on goods coming into their market. In the United States, to sort of where I focus on the most, because that's where we're based, it seems like the road to a price on carbon is pretty far away. Something that dramatic, that bold on climate's going to be a really tough sell, because big business and oil and gas industries are going to fight that tooth and nail. There are things that we can do, though, that can really help. So the government can impose quality restrictions on the voluntary carbon market credits that are sold in the US. And then it can help these technologies scale. And you see this in the Inflation Reduction Act. They can put money behind some of these solutions and help them scale outside of a voluntary carbon market context. So they're putting money in, the government is acting as a purchaser, essentially, of carbon removal, putting money into direct air capture and those sorts of technologies. And I think we'll start seeing them put money into enhanced rock weathering very shortly. In fact, they've said that they are going to. So that money will start getting deployed in that space as well. And you think about it from a government perspective, that makes way more sense, honestly, than I think the carbon market, as it looks today, scaling to 1 billion tons, which doesn't totally make sense. One of the challenges with the market is that it requires all of these carbon removal companies or actors acting in that space to measure, package, and sell 1 ton of carbon, right? That's what I'm going on in the market and buying. And that's this whole space in carbon removal called MRV, measuring, reporting, and verification. And that's the process of, well, how do you know that you removed a ton of carbon? If I'm buying that in the market, how sure can I be that you've done that? Now, the solutions that we have that probably scale to 1 billion tons of carbon removal every year, the best, pretty much all operate in open systems. That is to say, you're putting rock down in farmland, you're putting alkalizing agents in the ocean. The ocean's very hard to measure how much carbon you're absorbing. And you have models that are a bit fuzzy and give you some confidence that we're moving about this much or in this range. But if you are having to count and sell every individual ton of carbon, that's a lot of measuring. And when you need to count out $1 billion, you don't count every penny because it would take forever. Very expensive to do that. And it's actually very expensive to do that in this market. So really what we need is the government just coming in and saying, like, hey, do these activities. Once we figure out what works, we're going to pay you to do those activities, pay for practice, and not pay for measuring and selling and this overhead that honestly we can't afford as we try to scale these technologies.
Pray that Trump doesn't get in. Don't feel it's going to be moving that way if he's in power.
We might just be rolling coal as a country.
Yeah, exactly.
Essentially, just dumping carbon in the atmosphere just as a middle finger to the rest of the world and humanity if he gets in, unfortunately.
What about clean coal, John? The ultimate oxymoron. Of
clean coal, right?
Exactly.
Hey, it's fine if the world's on fire as long as you've owned the libs. Like, that's all that matters.
To give our audience a little bit of hope as we round out the session. Curious about, like, this question of, like, so that there's this great framework, Tempered Radicals, Deborah Meyerson. So I would call you a tempered radical, John. People who are in inside institutions making really significant change. So you got one of the major companies of our time to kind of shift and to, you know, become carbon neutral and to decarbonize, and that's huge, right? So, like, what advice would you give to other folks who are fellow tempered radicals inside institutions, inside government, inside major companies, and how they navigated this tension between profit and the drive to just, you know, kind of emit more carbon to some extent, and, you know, putting the planet as a stakeholder, putting the planet first and leading the push and just navigating that natural tension that exists within companies? What guidance would you give them as they're trying to do what you did?
Yeah, I mean, I think I became our head of sustainability just by raising my hand and saying, I'm going to be our head of sustainability. I guess you can try to fire me,
yeah,
I guess, for that, but you don't have to pay me any more money and I'm just going to do it. And I'm going to keep doing my job really well, but I'm going to start steering the ship in the right direction on this stuff. And they were happy to do it because they believed in these things. They just didn't have any of the capacity or position to steer that ship at that time. And I think a lot of people have a lot of agency within their organizations to help shape how that organization approaches issues like climate. You will find people that are concerned about this, leaders that are concerned about this and don't know exactly what to do about it and are a bit afraid, honestly, of how to thread the needle of the day in, day out, or month in, month out challenges of running a business, which is really challenging, right? You have to hit these numbers, you have to hit quarterly reports, you've got a lot of pressure on you as an executive, but also look at the world kind of falling apart. And if you can play a role in helping them find that path between those two things that says, well, here's how we can start moving in the right direction. It's going to be good for our business. That'll set us up to be more resilient as the climate crisis continues to get worse, as regulations become like stronger and stronger. We're going to be in a stronger position and more resilient. We're going to have a better relationship with our customers if we can make these moves now and start learning how to decarbonize, start learning how to participate in these markets and be a leader. It is really helpful. And there's a ton of business value in doing those activities. frequently companies just need someone to raise their hand and say like, hey, I can start leading on this. And you can have a tremendous impact in your organization frequently if by doing that. And it's not just, I should say, on climate, it's not just counting carbon emissions and the sort of voluntary carbon market participation. It can be ways of engaging in lobbying, which we do. So we advocate for climate legislation, the federal and level and in New York State quite frequently, cooperating with other businesses. And we've taken steps to try to help the companies that fund on Kickstarter also limit their environmental impact and create resources for them and guides for how to be more sustainable. There's levers inside every business. And the question is, well, what levers can you get access to? And what levers can you start painting a picture for your leadership of saying like, look, if I start pulling on this lever, I'm motivated to do it because, you know, I'm motivated on climate. And I'll figure out with you how this can work for the company. I'm not working in opposition to you, I'm working with you. And that's the story you always have to tell in order to make radical change within large institutions.
Talking about pushing that out to, you know, all the many Kickstarter ventures, like that's where you can reach true scale and sort of grow beyond just the work that you're doing internally. And that's in line with the Kickstarter spirit. Bring a creative, or in this case, a sustainability project to life. I mean, that's magical. So amazing to see you pushing that out. Obviously, the 4-day work week, you know, campaign has major implications for reducing carbon emissions as well. And it's nice to see, you know, all those different missions stitched together, you know, into coherent narrative that's been, you know, your career. So this has been a fantastic conversation, John. Really appreciate you jumping on the pod today. John Leland, Chief Strategy Officer at Kickstarter, sustainability leader, has helped Kickstarter decarbonize and basically become one of the major leaders in the, you know, movement to reduce carbon emissions. So we're really grateful to have you on the pod today, John.
Thank you both so much.
Where can folks find out more about the good work you're doing at Kickstarter and all of the efforts that you're working on currently in terms of sustainability?
I mean, you can check out kickstarter.com/environment, and you can follow me on LinkedIn, where I'll post or wind up posting about a lot of these efforts.
And also just wanted to just shout out to our listeners. Thanks for another great episode. Tech Can Save Us. Don't forget to like, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating so we can keep getting more amazing guests like John on to talk about things like the voluntary carbon market and other fun, nerdy tech things. So thanks, everybody. Have a great week.